The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the show, our last one here for the month of October. We're going to spend the first 30 minutes of the show abroad looking at a couple of different issues. We're going to start first by talking about the legal world abroad, talking to good folks from LegalLink. We're going to spend our second segment talking to some business leaders about doing business in the Middle East. Then we'll bring things back home for our third segment to talk about the recent unveiling, today's unveiling, of the health care reform plan in the House of Representatives and where things stand on that issue in both the House and the Senate, and then wrap up with the hot political issues of the day, including the big elections next week. But let's start with the international legal community. Our guests during this segment are Doug Mishkin, a lawyer here in Washington, D.C., who is the chairman of a group called LegalLink, and two of his fellow LegalLink members. We have Bert Ortner from Germany and Jana Felixova from the Czech Republic. So welcome to all of you. And Doug, let's kick things off with you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what LegalLink is and what you all do?
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. LegalLink is a network of law firms around the world. We have about 62 members as we speak, and they come from 46 different countries. The network was founded in 1990, and the entire purpose of the network is to enable law firms to have personal relationships with lawyers around the world, to be able to serve clients who have interests abroad, and for law firms to be able to hustle business together. I'm delighted we have on the phone with us two of my LegalLink colleagues and good friends. Bert Ortner is from Vienna, and Jana Felixova is from the Prague in the Czech Republic.
Bert, my apologies for getting the country wrong here. I failed European history in college.
No problem.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Bert and Jana. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what your legal practice involves there abroad? And we'll start with Jana. Tell us a little bit about your experience.
Well, hello, everybody. Our office, Felix Aspol at Atomic Effect Law, is based in Prague, and we do quite a lot of international work, namely in the sphere of commercial law, establishing new businesses, and in past years, quite a lot of investors were coming to the Czech Republic. So we did have an opportunity to work on this part of the work. But our legal work also involves, for example, labor law issues, which is covering also the labor force movement, not only within EU, but we have also, for example, U.S. companies which established the businesses here. So it's quite interesting work, and LegalLink is providing us with the opportunity to refer the cases and to work together on these international issues. So this
Bert,
is really
tell us a little
thing.
Bit about your practice there in Vienna.
Well, Austria, in Austria, the practice is rather diverse. Law firms tend to be rather small. Our firm is about number 10 in Austria with 25 lawyers. We do quite big deals. I mean, deals that you would also consider big in the U.S. We I personally was involved in a share purchase agreement of a group called Constantia, which was sold 2 weeks ago.
Bert, you're fading in and out. Can you sit a little closer?
Oh, okay, yeah. I was involved in a 440 million euro transaction sale of a company with 6,000 plus employees 2 weeks ago, which was probably Austria's largest transaction this year in terms of value. But we also do smaller things. Today I was in court in a litigation of a gentleman who was fired and who was suing for 5,000 euros. So you cannot compare the practice in Austria to the law practice that you're used in the U.S. We tend to do a lot of international work as well. Since Austria is so small, many business transactions are just transported transactions automatically. And that means we need a good and efficient legal network, and we're happy to be members of LegalLink.
Great. Doug, tell us a little bit about how the network actually operates on a day-to-day basis.
The whole premise of the network is that lawyers are going to get to know each other, to establish personal relationships with each other, so that when a client of mine has a need for an employment lawyer in the Czech Republic, I'm able to say, as I have done, call Jana Felixova. I know her. I've worked with Jana. We've spent time together. We've been in committee meetings together. We've had lunch and dinner together. I know this person. You can trust she'll do a good job for you. So it's all about personal relationships, which means we meet twice a year. And we do that because that's the only way we can get to know each other. Between the meetings, we're doing things like publishing an electronic newsletter where we take articles that all of the different firms have already written and republish them so that all the other members of LegalLink get to see what the member firms are writing about and to be able to share those publications with their own clients and partners and prospective clients. So we do publications. We've now started to have regional conference calls where members will get on the phone with each other once a month to talk about business and legal opportunities.
Very good. Well, Doug, I know just from doing a little research, there's obviously similar networks that are out there. Tell us a little bit about what makes LegalLink unique compared to those other networks of international lawyers.
Sure. There are other networks that are of the size where if you said, I need a law firm in Ireland, what you would do is pick up a directory, find Ireland, and then see the law firm or firms that are listed for Ireland. That's not us. Our network is all about the personal relationships, such that when a partner of mine says, I need a litigation firm in Ireland, I'm able to say, well, let's call Bernard McAvoy. I know Bernard. That's the difference. We're smaller. We're not 500 members or 1,000 members like some other networks, but it's based upon the personal relationships, which means when you join, you're making a commitment not only to pay your dues, but to come to the meetings and to actively participate. If you don't come to the meetings, we can't get to know you, and it doesn't work.
Gotcha. Well, Bert, tell us a little bit about your experience with the network.
Well, we are very pleased. I agree with Doug that it makes a lot of sense to meet the fellow colleagues on a twice a year or at least once a year, and to know what to expect from them. I have been an associate in a larger law firm that is now Freshfields in Vienna, and I know how anonymous these big associations tend to be, and I agree with Doug that it makes a lot of sense to know the people. Normally, you do need fast, quick advice. You want to be better than the other lawyers here at your local place, and you want to be able to get information faster from your colleagues of the network, and it makes a lot of sense just to know the guy on the phone and to be able to trust him, and he will be doing what he can to get me in touch with, if it's not Doug himself, to get me in touch with one of his colleagues to give me advice on a preferential basis, hopefully. You know, normally that's my experience.
And Jana, what about you? Are there things you could add to your experience about your experience with the network?
Yeah, definitely. I can confirm what Doug and Barrett said. And just an example, it provides you with a very quick possibility to react towards your clients. For example, last week, Marcus Jacobi from Berlin addressed me with a request of his client regarding the trademark issue. And today we filed an opposition with the Czech Industrial Property Office representing the client, and we did everything very quickly, even without the contract with the client, and simply just communicating through the members, through Marcus, the conditions, and he can say, I know Jana, and I can say, yes, we can do it, and it works really quickly. Otherwise, the German client would be looking for the legal representative in the Czech Republic, and it would take him, I would say, definitely longer time than 3 days to complete the whole legal service and to be in time, which actually was this time very short because the client was deciding very slowly and only at the last moment decided to file an opposition with the Industrial Property Office in Prague. So, and we did this very quickly. So this is real example of the cooperation, yeah.
Doug, I've got about 90 seconds left, so just in wrapping up, can you talk about what sort of issues lend themselves to collaboration and how, if people are interested in contacting the Legal Link Network, how they can come into contact with you guys?
Sure. There are certain issues that lend themselves to cross-border cooperation because they're inherently cross-border. So, for example, more and more frequently when companies are contemplating layoffs, they involve employees who are in more than one jurisdiction. That's why I've just edited a book that Legal Link has published on summarizing laws pertaining to layoffs around the world. And Jana's and Bert's firms both contributed to that book. I have a colleague here at Patent Box who does anti-money laundering work. She's assembling a mini network within Legal Link of law firms that do that kind of work to enable her to have global reach. Anyone who's interested in learning more about the network can contact me at Patton Boggs or go to the Legal Link website, which is www.legallink.ch.
Great. Well, guys, thank you very much. We've had Jana Filixova from the Czech Republic, Bert Ortner from Vienna, Austria, and Doug Mishkin from the United States talking about Legal Link. We're come back in just a minute with some folks from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to talk about doing business abroad. Keep it here on Capital Thinking until then.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202- 457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Football.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the show. Well, good segment there on international law. Now we're going to talk a little bit about international business. Joining us, we've got three folks for this segment, including one of our favorite regular contributors, David Tafuri, who is a lawyer who focuses on Middle Eastern business development. Also with us, though, is Joe Faulkner, the Director for International Development and Aid for the United States Chamber of Commerce, and Yasmin Modamedi, who's the Executive Director for Middle Eastern Affairs at the United States Chamber of Commerce. So welcome to all of you today. And, Dave, let's kick things off by maybe having you or Yasmin talk a little bit about this recent Iraq investment conference that you all participated in.
Sure, Kevin. Thanks for having me on again. I was on your show a few weeks ago and talked a little bit about the investment conference before it happened, and it just concluded, and it was a great success. We had something like 800 participants, about 250 to 300 Iraqis flew over. That was a mix of Iraqi officials and Iraqi private company representatives. Prime Minister Maliki headed up the delegation, and there were also some other very notable Iraqi officials, including the Minister of Oil, Hussein Sherastani, and the head of the National Investment Commission, Dr. Sami Al-Araji. And it was a very well-attended conference. There was a lot of enthusiasm for investing in Iraq. Of course, investing is not for the faint of heart, but there are incredible opportunities in Iraq right now, and the really great participation from U.S. companies is evidence of that. And the fact that a lot of companies are really interested in Iraq and trying to figure out how to get there and take advantage of the opportunities.
Yeah, Yasmin and Joe, let me ask you, tell us a little bit about what the climate for investing in a place like Iraq is right now.
Well, the security and economic progress in Iraq, especially since 2003, has put Iraq back on the map in terms of becoming one of the most attractive emerging markets in the world, where gaining access and making deals happen will result in substantial revenues. And there are several American companies that have gone in there and taken that chance, the risk, and they've benefited greatly. However, you know, in learning how to get in there and find the right opportunities to avoid the pitfalls that are still there in terms of legal pitfalls and others, it's become a challenge to American companies. And to that end, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce organized a program called the Iraq Business Initiative back in 2008. The initiative is now a year and a half old, do two things: to deliver targeted advocacy on behalf of American business, as well as giving these American companies access to the key decision makers within Iraq and in the United States. And basically, the initiative offers businesses the opportunity to impact the policies that are being shaped in the long-term investment climate of Iraq through, you know, having this the networking opportunities, going on delegations, going to policy forums, and meeting the key decision makers in Iraq.
Well, Joe, you get sort of the tough question then. I know if I, you know, came home at night and talked to my wife, say, hey, I'm about to take a business trip to Baghdad to get the next big, catch the next big thing, she'd be pretty worried about Al-Qaeda there and, you know, the circumstances that that I would face. So tell me a little bit about the threat of Al-Qaeda to American businesses in a place like Iraq.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I can share with you my story very quickly. I went to Iraq. We had a delegation, particularly in Kurdistan this past August, and I can tell you my wife was a little bit worried. You know, her basic questions were, look, is this a secure place for you to go? I'm worried about you. And the interesting thing, this is the...
And where'd you leave the insurance policy?
Yeah, exactly. Where did you sign up with the Chamber's insurance policy? Do you have so security is clearly a big issue. The insurgency is still an issue, obviously, in Iraq. People read the newspapers. But what I have found, and by the way, my background is mostly, my background is in developing markets, but particularly in China, but what I found was very interesting is that the fact is that the most of Iraq is secure. There has been a drastic reduction in the levels of violence and compromises amongst as much could be possible since the years, particularly 2006 and 2007. And as we, in our job, particularly here at the Chamber, is to engage new companies or companies that were there, you know, back in the 80s and 70s who are now looking to go back. Our biggest challenge, and I agree with you, is kind of bridging that perception that Iraq has made great strides, obviously with the help of the coalition, U.S. military, to improve their security situation, and that Iraq is very much a place that is open with business. And when companies go there, their biggest concerns go from security then to areas like corruption or the protection of intellectual property or holding up contracts. Those are concerns that, frankly, you know, we're glad to see, that companies go out there, they see the security situation has improved, and that's part of our job, is to get companies out there, small, medium, and large, frankly, and to help spread the word that, look, Iraq is a place that is coming out of years of warfare, but their business communities, including their chambers of commerce, their entrepreneurs, are ready to do business. They want to increase their standard of living. They want to make money. They want to produce investment. They want to produce innovation. And my task is a bit challenging in the sense of convincing companies, say, hey, join us. Come out here. We'll introduce you to the people that matter. And you'll see that things have changed for the better. And lo and behold, a lot of these companies come back with a different perception, which is part of our job, is to working with government stakeholders, both U.S. and Iraqi government stakeholders, to bring in that key critical mass of companies to invest in key sectors, not just oil and gas, but key infrastructure sectors such as agriculture or construction or information technology, financial services. These are areas that are in dire need throughout Iraq, business know-how, technology transfer. So my job and Yasmin's job in working with Dave Tafiri is challenging in the sense that getting companies away from their eyes of looking at these headline news stories that we see. Our focus is to help the business community understand that there is a different side of Iraq that has been improved. So the security situation and the perception is still a challenge, but we have made great strides in getting new companies out there or companies that have not been engaged in recent years. And it has been met with success, and companies now are garnering more attention and saying, look, I'll be willing to go with you. There is still an element of risk involved, but I'll take your word for it. Let me go see. And they come back pleasantly surprised.
Well, let me jump here. My wife has just emailed me and said I'm free to go to Baghdad as long as I'm back by Christmas.
Right, so
that's good to know. Dave, I'll go with you on the next trip. Dave, walk me through some of the steps here in our last couple minutes of what you and Joe and Yasmin would recommend for a company that wants to do business? Okay, they're interested, they're intrigued by what you offer here. What are their next steps to get into the game?
Sure. Like many other countries in the Middle East, in Iraq, the best way to secure a business opportunity and execute a business deal is to form relationships with the government of Iraq and Iraqi private sector representatives. And that takes, that takes some work. That takes visiting Iraq, and that takes meeting with those officials here in the U.S. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is really an excellent forum for accomplishing that. Yasmin has done a fantastic job of forming very strong relationships with the key government of Iraq officials, and just about any time a government of Iraq official comes to the U.S. and comes to Washington, D.C., she sets up a meeting with them. Normally, it's a meeting for companies that are members of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or close friends of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're usually small, intimate meetings and provide a great forum for talking about the best opportunities in Iraq and how to take advantage of those opportunities. Yasmin and Joe also arrange delegations to Iraq that facilitates further communication and allows the companies to actually spec out potential opportunities and really get closer to a deal. And I think that's the important part. Form that relationship, strengthen that relationship. It's not going to happen overnight, but for companies that are very interested and committed, and especially companies that are willing to take advantage of the advantages that the U.S. Chamber and U.S. Chamber membership offers, they've got a great opportunity.
Joe and Yasmin, I've got about a minute left. Do you have anything to add to what Dave said?
In addition to, the access, providing access to our members, we've also worked on worked on policy issues that have been really instrumental in terms of facilitating travel to Iraq and eliminating some of the security concerns. Just this past summer, in coordination with the KRG representative to the United States, Kubal Talabani, and the Chamber of Commerce, among other partners, convinced the State Department to revise the travel advisory for Iraq. And they went ahead and they revised it with respect to Kurdistan. It's no longer, Kurdistan is no longer a red area for travel. So, and we look forward to working with State Department in revising and similarly distinguishing other safe and secure regions of Iraq.
Terrific. Let me ask, we've got to wrap things up, but real fast, do you guys have a web address that people can visit if they're interested in the Iraq Business Initiative over at the Chamber?
Yes, we do. It's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce website, which is www.uschamber.com. And if you click on the International Division link, it'll give you an option for Middle East, Africa Division, and we have a write-up on the Iraq Business Initiative on that link.
All right. Well, many thanks to our guests this segment, Dave Tafuri, a lawyer specializing in business development over in the Middle East. Yasmin Motamedi, the Executive Director of Middle Eastern Affairs for the United States Chamber of Commerce, and her colleague, Joe Faulkner, the Director for International Development over at the Chamber of Commerce. We'll be right back in just a moment to talk about health care reform.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, well, big day today in Washington, D.C. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi appearing on the Capitol steps just about 90 minutes ago to unveil her health care reform plan that she says the House of Representatives will vote on as soon as the end of next week. With us to talk about what's in that plan and also where things stand in the United States Senate and what next steps are coming is John Jonas, the head of the health care policy practice group of the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., and a frequent contributor and appearer here on Capital Thinking. Mr. Jonas, how are you today?
I'm good.
Well, so tell us a little bit about this House-introduced bill that Speaker Pelosi unveiled this morning.
Well, as you watch health care reform play itself out, maybe we ought to rename the show from Capital Thinking to Capital Confusion. Since you've got an awful lot of different moving pieces running around on healthcare reform at the moment. What happened today, and you're right, today's an important day. The bill that has been worked its way through three separate House committees has finally been knitted together and introduced into the House of Representatives. It represents the Democrats' best effort at knitting together their various factions, from the liberals who probably still hold out in their hearts a hope for a single-payer plan sometime out into the future, down to moderate Democrats who really want to see very much of a market-based system preserved. And this is her shot at trying to pull all of those folks together. You know, we have a lot of the debate has been around this so-called public option. There are lots of other provisions in the bill. This is sort of grab the attention of folks, and maybe it'd be worth just a second to go through sort of the moving pieces here on the public option. So,
yeah, sure. Now, my understanding is she took a look at her choices inside of her Democratic majority and discovered that the liberals didn't have the vote for their preferred public option, and she's gone with what is more geared towards what the moderates have been requesting. Is that right?
Right. You got it. First of all, you have to understand there. Everybody agrees we're going to have these health exchanges, which are these entities through which people can buy insurance. And so the threshold question is, are they just going to be able to buy the commercial plans that are out there, or is there some government-sponsored plan that's a competitor there? So that's kind of the threshold question. Do you have a public option or no public option? Then there are all the variations on the themes. There's the question of whether states, which is in the Senate, whether states can opt out of offering a public plan so that even if there was a public option nationally, a state could vote that their exchange does not offer the public option. That seems to provide some relief in the Senate. Then there are questions about this public option, really, what is the payment standard that is used? And there's been a lot of debate about that. Would the public option pay Medicare rates, just mirror what's done in the Medicare system? And some people argue that Medicare rates are too low, so there have been proposals to pay Medicare plus 5% or 10%.
By some people, you mean doctors, providers,
right, doctors, people who provide medical services, I think, are worried that, especially in rural areas, the Medicare rates, payment rates are really below what commercial rates are, and that they would be disadvantaged. And so where the House has ended up is that this public option would pay negotiated rates, namely the public option would have to go out, like any commercial insurance company does, and negotiate rates with hospitals and physician groups and other medical providers in the area in which the public plan is providing services. So the House bill would put the public option much more on an equal par with commercial insurers. I think this satisfies some of the moderate Democrats. I don't think it satisfies any of the Republicans. And query, does it satisfy enough of the moderate Democrats to give her the vote she needs to pass it on the floor? I think there's always debate about head counts, but I think conventional wisdom is she may still be a couple of votes shy of the majority she needs to pass it on the House floor.
And, Joe, right now we're not thinking that any House Republicans would actually vote for the bill as it's currently constituted, right?
No. And I don't think that, I think the House Republicans are opposed to a whole variety of provisions in the bill. And certainly they would not vote for it if it had a public option, regardless of how that public option is constructed.
And Arthur, you know, as I look at it, it seems like the public option has sort of sucked all the public attention up, but there are some other issues below the surface that seem like the Speaker Pelosi is going to have to navigate to get to that magic number of 218 between now and the day she votes. And you know, there are things like some moderate Democrats who are upset about whether or not the language is clear enough on abortion funding restrictions. There's the doc fix, which is still hanging out there, and there's the question of whether or not there's going to be any sort of adjustment to the rates paid to rural health care providers. Can you talk a little bit about some of those challenges?
Right, yeah. They're the issues, I think, that bedevil legislation in a lot of different areas, and you've hit on a couple of the hot-button issues, abortion, to what extent will health plans that are subsidized directly or indirectly by the federal government cover abortion services, and that's always very, very controversial. There's substantial discrepancy in the rates paid for services in urban and rural settings. Often in rural settings you have fewer providers and less competition and therefore higher rates. And has the plan gone far enough in addressing these payment discrepancies? There's the bedeviling problem, which Congress has been fixing on a one-year basis, of the problems in the formula that calculates the payment rates for doctors under the Medicare program. And they're looking at something approaching a 20% cut in their payment rates unless that's fixed. That's been a part of health care reform. The Democrats made an effort to break that out of health care reform and pass it without paying for it, and that's gone down to defeat. So that remains a problem. So there are lots and lots of issues. And then I think, you know, an issue that's been the subject of a lot of debate but not in the press is really this level of what level of subsidies are there going to be for individuals who really can't afford health insurance, and how are those subsidies going to be distributed? The House bill makes a substantial expansion of the state-run Medicaid program, which addresses the health care needs of lower-income individuals, takes that number up to about 150% of poverty. Obviously, states share in the cost of the Medicaid program, so there's a lot of sensitivity at the state level about how you expand the Medicare program. So, yes, Kevin, you're right. There are just lots and lots of bedeviling problems in a bill of this size and this magnitude. And it's regardless of what you think of the bill, it's probably a little bit testament to the system that with all the controversial and difficult issues, they've actually gotten this this far in the process.
Well, it's certainly an interesting statement that a majority in both chambers of Congress is not what it could be, I suppose, that they're certainly not ramming anything through since we're 10 months into the year and still don't have anything. You know, tell us a little bit about what's going on in the Senate. I've got about 2 minutes here to wrap things up, but where do things stand in the Senate, and what do you see as the next steps here in the week ahead?
Yeah, well, the House has just obviously introduced its bill and completed that melding process. The Senate has not introduced its bill because it's not completed that melding process, and they only have two bills to meld. The House had three, but it remains challenging in the Senate. A lot of debate, again, around this public option, a lot of debate around these levels of subsidies, and there are a lot more, whatever you want to call them, tax fees, charges in the Senate bill. The House bill relies primarily on a surtax of those making over $1 million, and the Senate has a lot more fees, so that's a lot more controversial. I think it's going to take Leader Reid quite a bit longer to pull that all together, so maybe it's going to be at least another 2 weeks or so before the bill hits the Senate floor. And, of course, the process in the Senate, with its lack of rules, allows for long, long debate and amendment process. So we're probably going to see a bill within the next 2 weeks, and it's probably going to be on the Senate floor for at least a month.
So realistically, I'm sitting at the kitchen table for Christmas. Do we have a health care reform bill done and signed into law by Christmas, or do you see this moving into next year now?
Well, Don, I don't think signed into law. Will there be a final vote before Christmas? I think actually the conference itself may move quite quickly. The general thinking is that the House and Senate bills are pretty different. It's going to take a long time to resolve differences. In my discussions with senior staff in both leadership, in the House and the Senate, once they get the bills off the floor, they don't want to see, obviously that means they've gotten the votes they needed. They're very worried about any erosion, and so they're going to try and do the conference quickly and get a vote on the conference report before Christmas. I think that's still possible. I would give it a 51.5% chance of being done by Christmas.
All right, everybody. John Jonas hedging his bets on whether or not we have health care reform by Christmas. John, thanks for joining the show. We'll certainly have you back perhaps as soon as next week to talk more developments there. We'll be back in a minute to talk about the hot political stories of the day.
Thanks, Kevin.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, weekend. I hope everybody's got great plans for the weekend. I myself am getting ready for a weekend of activities with the youngsters. Got a birthday party for the soon-to-be 7-year-old, Harry Potter-themed. And of course, we'll be dressed as Harry Potter for the Halloween celebration on Saturday as we go to door-to-door. And while the little sister of Harry Potter will be dressed as Minnie Mouse. And big events this weekend. Got the mother-in-law rolling into town for the festivities and whatnot, so we'll have to be on our best behavior at home this weekend, perhaps not put our feet up on the table quite so much. And but nevertheless, let us transition back to some of the big political issues of the day. Let me hit health care, just wrap up a couple thoughts from John Jonas in our last segment here. I think it's very interesting that Republicans have not yet put forth their own plan, and now the pressure should rightfully be on them to not just be the party of no to the Democratic proposals, but to say what they would do if they were passing a health care reform bill today. We know what some of the building blocks would be. We'd know they'd have legal reform in there, malpractice reform that the Democrats have decided not to put in their package. We know that they would have some universal portability, allowing people to take their insurance plan across state lines, shop across state lines, which I also think is one of those good ideas. But what is the rest of their plan for health care reform? I think it's a strategic political mistake for them not to introduce their own legislation this year and tell people that we're not just voting no against the Democratic plan. Here's our plan, and here's why it's better. Now, I think the Speaker is going to have a significant amount of difficulty getting to 218 votes here in the next week or so. I wouldn't be surprised to see that House vote slip by a few days as she tries to round up votes. I think John did a great job of synopsizing some of the challenges around funding for abortion and rural health care, some of these other issues that really do matter. Issue there will be on abortion, that the Catholic bishops have come out against the Democratic health plan on abortion, and they'll be very concerned about whether or not their issue will be heard by the majority and whether or not they'll change that language and forbid public funding to go on to it. Let's talk a little bit about the hot races. We're only a few days away from the elections on Tuesday. Three big elections that everybody's tracking. We'll start in the Virginia gubernatorial race. Polls today have the Republican candidate, Bob McDonnell, with about a 12 to 15-point lead over Democrat Kray Deeds. The president came down and has given an 11th-hour appearance in Norfolk, trying to fire up the base that came out and gave him a victory in Virginia last year. Doesn't look like they're going to turn out again this year. And so the political narrative will be from the Republican side that this is an important change. A purple state has gone back to red. Obama has blown his natural advantage there, et cetera, ending 8 years of Democratic rule in the statehouse. The Democratic narrative will be, well, look, Virginia is always a state where after a presidential election, the next gubernatorial election flips to the other party, the party that's out of power. And so this is simply no different. This is just the way it's always been. In Virginia, they'll try, Democrats will in particular try to minimize the damage of the imminent McDonnell election. And in fact, if anything, we might start to see them play the point spread game. Well, he was down by 15, but he only lost by 5. If in fact that comes to play, it wasn't as bad a loss as we thought. At the end of the day, it does matter because Virginia is a purple state. It's the kind of state Obama will have to be competitive in 3 years from now to get reelected. And it's very clear his opinion polls have declined sharply in the state, and approval of his performance and the performance in Congress has declined sharply, and that's why Cray Deeds had to run away from him and stay away from him. And despite that, he'll still lose the election this week. Now, turning to New Jersey and that governor's race, that's a much more fascinating picture. As you look at the polling data today, it looks like the incumbent, John Corzine, former United States Senator, current Democrat, it looks like he has poured enough of his own personal fortune in there to come back. He's got a lead as high as 5 points, I believe, in a couple of the polls that have come out in the last couple of days. It's a three-candidate race there. He's running against Chris Christie, who's a former Republican, who's a Republican and a former federal prosecutor. Christie has run what appears to be a pretty lackluster campaign. You have to wonder if Republicans don't regret not being able to get a member of Congress to enter that race, or somebody who was an elected official at the state level who had a track record and some experience in politics, because Christie looks like he could be blowing what would have been a good opportunity for him to get elected. Chris Daggett, who's the third-party candidate in New Jersey, has an awful lot to say about who's going to win on Tuesday. In fact, if you look at the polling data from the last week or so, Daggett polls anywhere from 7% to 13%, and it's clear he's taking most of those votes away from the Republican candidate. Where Daggett polls about 13%, that's where Corzine has a clear lead. When Daggett polls down around 7%, you have an even race, or Chris Christie's actually ahead by a point or two. So very interesting to see if all those people who are thinking today, hey, I'm going to vote for the third-party guy, when they get in the voter booth on Tuesday, and they know that third-party guy isn't going to win, they have to ask themselves, are they going to be the spoiler? And if they're not the spoiler, are they going to go back home to the incumbent, or are they going to go to this challenger? At the end of the day, I think Corzine is either going to squeak through by a point, or he's going to lose by a point. And if you had to press me on it today, I'd say he's going to squeak through by just a point or two. New Jersey is a blue state at the end of the day. It's been a blue state for quite a while. And enough people, I think, are going to come home to Corzine. He'll spend a lot of money in the next 4 days on TV ads. Having the president there has been a net positive for him, unlike Virginia. And he's not running against the best candidate that could be out there. That's one of the reasons the third-party candidate has done so well. So I think you're going to see a split in the governor's races this week, a draw with Virginia going red and with New Jersey staying blue. And then good luck to both of those governors. It would be a tough time to govern in this fiscal environment. Let's talk about the House race. There's a House race in upstate New York, New York 23rd, that will be decided next week. This is to fill the seat of John McHugh, a Republican who retired to become President Obama's Secretary of the Army. There's a three-candidate race as well here. What's fascinating is the third-party candidate seems to have the lead and all of the momentum. This is Doug Hoffman. Hoffman wanted to run as a Republican. He wasn't selected in the process, so he ran as a third party. Hoffman has split the Republican Party in two. The Republican nominee is very liberal, has voted for a lot of liberal issues in the state house, and so as a result, a lot of national conservative politicians, Sarah Palin, Tim Pawlenty, have gotten behind the third-party candidate, and a lot of mainstream establishment Republicans, like your House leaders and the National Republican Congressional Committee, has stuck with the Republican nominee. The Democrats, this is a plurality election, so Democrats only have to come in first. Their candidate seems to poll about the same, and they really don't know where to direct their fire. They don't know if they should direct it at this third-party guy with the new momentum, that seems to be what they've done the last week or so, or direct it at the Republican, who could be in danger of finishing third. I think it's going to be a very interesting race next week. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see the conservative third-party candidate pull it off. And if so, I think you'll see a ton of political analysis come out of it about what it means for Republicans and Democrats in the 2010 election. And what it really means, when all is said and done, is that there is going to be a lot a lot of voter distrust of establishment candidates and credible third-party candidates who come with a game plan, like Doug Hoffman has come up with, will be heard, they'll be well-funded, and they'll have legitimate chances in a lot of races that they haven't had chances in before. That can happen in an off-year election when the presidential election and the doesn't suck all the oxygen out of the room. So if you ask me to predict, I say Hoffman's going to pull off an upset next week, and it will bring a lot of lessons to everybody to have. Well, listen, I hope everyone has a great Halloween. I'm off to the party for a seven-year-old and Halloween itself. We'll see you next week with another good edition of Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.